Welcome to Hebrew Bible Insights, a podcast about making sense of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Matthew Delaney, and today I have my co-host, Dr. Nathan French. And today we're going to talk about one of the most captivating sections and one of the most important sections of the entire Hebrew Bible, and that's Genesis chapter 1. We're going to talk about particularly the first two verses and ask ourselves the question, what's going on in these verses? Genesis 1 has inspired so much deep study of Scripture, and yet it's also sparked intense debates amongst people of faith. What's going on here? So I understand that there are people listening to this podcast who come from both sides of the aisle and all over the spectrum when it comes to interpreting Genesis 1. And what Dr. French and I want to do is we simply want to give some information from our areas of expertise, the Hebrew language and the ancient Near East context as we approach the Hebrew Bible, and see how that can contribute to all of us having a more robust understanding of Genesis chapter 1. And as with all of our conversations, we want to do it in a way of respect, and that's the tone we want to have when we do deep dives into controversial areas like this. So anyway, we're going to talk about creation, we're going to talk about the idea of chaos, the gap theory, but we're going to spend most of our time looking at some key Hebrew words, tohu, vavohu. These words normally translate as formless and void, what's going on there. We're also going to look at other ancient Near East context, other different stories that we have from the ancient Near East world, and look at their cultures, and how does all of this maybe add some insight into how we interpret the very important chapter of Genesis 1. And you'll want to stay especially for the end, because we really tie it all in with some really devotional, pastoral insights that we think we get from approaching this very important chapter. I'd love to continue the discussion with you. Podcast platforms aren't a great place for that, so always feel free to hop over to YouTube to listen to the video version of this and post in the comments. We'd love to hear your thoughts. If you want more of our content, you can find us on YouTube, podcast platforms, as well as a number of social media places like Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And if you want to support us financially and get access to exclusive content, you can find us on Patreon. Links to all of this are in the show notes below. So without further ado, let's go ahead and dive into today's episode. What is going on in Genesis chapter 1? Is there chaos? Is there wildness going on here in the creative Wild West? Sorry, I'm getting a little crazy here. This is going to be a fun conversation we're going to have together today. I mean, I think everybody loves talking about the early Genesis chapters. They're fascinating. Before I kick it to you, I remember the first time I thought about Genesis chapter 1, the first couple of verses, what's going on at the beginning of this creation story, like what's happening here. It was actually in second grade, because I really wanted to be a paleontologist. I love dinosaurs.
Who doesn't want to be a paleontologist, you know?
Yeah, right. It's so good. Didn't you want to be a paleontologist?
I did, yeah. Actually, there was a time there where I thought this would be... It was probably when Jurassic Park came out, I suppose, so.
So epic. I remember my parents, you know, letting me watch that movie late at night, way past my bedtime. And that was a really fun memory for me. Yeah, I mean, I was all in. I pretended to be a dinosaur as a little toddler, you know, going around roaring at people, and I promise I wasn't crazy. But yeah, I had a lot of blast studying dinosaurs. Those are all the books that go to the library, get like 20 dinosaur books and read them. When I was sick, I'd have my mom read me nonfiction dinosaur facts, and I was all in it. So one time my dad came back from a trip, and he had got me this book that was like a It was like a Christian book basically explaining dinosaurs and giving a theory. And that's the first time in second grade I was introduced to the base of the gap theory.
Mm.
And this idea that there's this gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Right. And that is a place where it was just chaos and evil and darkness and dinosaurs. Correct. And everything. So anyway, that was my first introduction to getting interested into figuring out what is going on here.
Well, let's go there with that gap theory, especially for our listeners who may not know this, right? So, of course, we have your Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, we see here Bereshit bara Elohim et haShamayim ve et haAretz. Then verse 2, ve haAretz haita tohu vavohu. So if we were to translate Genesis 1:1, we could say something like, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, or when God began to create the heavens and the earth, or at the time that God began to create the heavens and the earth. We can talk about this some.
Yeah.
And then verse 2, ve haaretz haita tohu vavohu, so, and the earth was tohu vavohu. It was something, whatever this means, maybe formless and void are some of the translations. Chaos can be sort of the idea that is thought to be behind these particular words. So the question is, basically, did God create it this way? And of course, there's a Jeremiah passage, I believe, that says God does not create in tohu vavohu, right? He does not create in that. So there is this theory out there, this gap theory, that something happened between verses 1 and verses 2. And as you know, some have tried to argue that this is when Satan fell, for example, theological sense. I've heard that. I've heard others say that this is when dinosaurs existed, so God destroyed the earth, and then between verses 1 and 2, and then we come back in at verse 2, and we're starting again. That's sort of the idea of the gap theory that we've heard.
I think this all is also used by some when it comes to debate of how old the earth is, where some will kind of hold like this is how they can maintain that, like for some, like that strict 6,000-ish year biblical history.
Yeah.
Being human history, but then trying to reconcile that with modern science and the age of the earth and the universe, and basically saying that the time gap between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 would basically be whatever it needs to be to make that the age of the earth and the universe fit. And then 6,000 years ago, Genesis 1:2 or Genesis 1:3 happened.
Yeah.
It's an interesting theory that, you know, tries to explain a lot of things.
Yeah, and it really brings you in because it's sort of fascinating with that. So,
yeah.
So what do you think about this Genesis 1:1? So if I was to ask Mati how to translate Genesis 1:1, where would you go with this?
Jeez, yeah, this is a big question. I think we're so used to in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, We would think, how could we even question that translation? I see it in so many translations. It feels like the standard. It's one of the verses that most people around, if they know a verse of the Bible, that's one of the ones they probably know. But there are some interesting little factoids where the first preposition is bi, not ba. It's not how it's pointed. So it's not technically pointed as in the beginning. So we have bereshit. So in beginning, literally, but that's also kind of weird. So that's where some translate it as almost like an adverbial clause that basically the preposition bet could be something more like when. So you go back to people like some of the rabbis in the Middle Ages, they would suggest a different vowel pointing for the second word, bara. Instead of bara being he created, i.e. God creating, they'd do it as bro. And so that... Yeah. So it doesn't change the consonants. The consonal text stays the same, but they make it into this infinitive where it then becomes creating. And who's creating? God's creating. So it's like in the beginning of God's creating. So in other words, when God began creating is how it then gets figured out. And, you know, so the difference, I think, could be either this is the literal, nothing else has happened before Genesis 1:1. This is in the beginning, and now we have the beginning of time. Or when God began creating the heavens and the earth. So that would then insinuate the author's not necessarily trying to tell you the very beginning of time, but it's trying to tell you a story about the beginning of this creation, this specific creation story act, you could say.
Right.
Because so then... when you translate that vav in verse 2 for, you know, and the earth was formless and void and darkness over the face of the deep, and the spirit of God hovers over the face of the waters, Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 are actually treated as one sentence. If you do when God began creating the heavens and the earth, it's then verse two is giving you the state of what things were when God started doing this creation story.
Yeah.
And so it would then basically be, there's another story we just don't have that we don't know about. And for whatever reason, things are the way they are. And that status is the earth is tohu and vohu. We'll talk about that later. What does that mean? And there's darkness over the face of the deep. And so there's some story we don't really have, but this is the state of where things are at currently. And now we're jumping into a specific story, which we're very familiar with, which is Genesis 1 and how God creates things. So honestly, I don't know where I land personally yet. I want to do more research myself, but those are the two main theories that people
have. Excellent. No, it was a great explanation. I'm glad you did it. And bringing up, of course, the dependent clause that we might have there in verse 1 leading into verse 2 as a full sentence. We see that here in two translations. We have the NRSV up here and we have the NET Bible as well. So if you look at the NET Bible translation, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, period. Mm-hmm. And we see here in the NRSV, they're going to go with a different translation, right? In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, comma, the earth was a formless void. So you see the difference there, right?
Yep. Yep.
And whether you want to admit it or not, we talked about this in another episode, I believe, with Pete, right? I think it was with Peter. We talked about how even the Nikud, the pointing of the text, we can see how this is sort of a running commentary already on a continental text, isn't it? It's already making decisions for us. And it's theologically important. It has implications. So that's kind of what we're dealing with here in Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Of course, our focus today is not to answer that question. Maybe we will go there at some other time, right? And to do more research in that and present the theories as they are. But our question today is really verse 2, Veha'aretz hayta tohu vavohu, vehoshech al pnei tehom. So we have the earth is tohu vavohu, was tohu vavohu, and we have darkness on the face of the tehom. So there is this theory, and has been this theory in biblical scholarship for some time, since the late 19th century, around 1895. I believe it was Hermann Gunkel, a very prolific and wonderful German scholar on the Hebrew Bible, who presented this theory that, in fact, what we have in verse 2 is indications of ancient Babylonian mythology, especially as it concerns a sort of chaos theory, that what we have here is a chaos motif, and that the God of Israel here is going to subdue the chaos and bring order to it, similar to what is in Enuma Elish, which is sometimes called the creation Babylonian narrative and story, but we will get into that here a bit further as to why that might not be the case. So anyways, we want to discuss this chaos conf theory that might be here in verse 2.
Yeah, and some of it has to do, some of their theory is based on some key vocabulary in this story. So this is a good episode for learning some Hebrew. And I know Tehom we'll probably get to, maybe that's better to bring up later. But a big part of this conversation is, what is tohu and what is vohu? Yeah. First off, I should just say, I love how they rhyme. That's just so fun. the phrase tohu vavohu, which, by the way, that's how Israeli mothers today will talk about their kid's bedroom if it's a huge mess.
It's tohu vohu. They'll say,
this is balagan, it's tohu vavohu, right? This is just, so I'm not, to be clear, I'm not saying we need to interpret Genesis 1 as a messy bedroom, but it's just fun how Israelis use some of these Hebrew idioms today. So vohu, as that word, I believe, let me double check this, but I think this word only appears twice in the Hebrew Bible, and both three times. Okay. So it appears three times, and each time it is used... Oh, interesting. It looks like there's one time where it's, or no, both, okay. Both time, all three times, whether it's Genesis 1:2, Isaiah 34:11, and Jeremiah 4:23, each time it is used in the construct with the phrase tohu. So vohu never appears by itself. And so this word is a lot more difficult to translate. What exactly is it? Whereas the word tohu does appear by itself. That word appears about 20 times in the Bible. And I think it'd be interesting to explore just a couple other ways that this word is used to see how we might understand this picture.
Yeah.
So tohu appears only twice in the whole Torah, the first five books, only twice. So you have Genesis 1-2, obviously. So the second one is Genesis 32, which an important passage, kind of poetic. I think this is this is part of Moses' speech, but there's a part where he breaks into kind of this epic poetry. Genesis 32:10. And
do you mean Deuteronomy? Or you mean Genesis?
Yes, sorry, Deuteronomy. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Yes, Deuteronomy 32:10. Yeah. So which reads, Vayimtza Ehu be'eretz midbar, uvetohu yelel yishmon. So we have, he found him in a desert land. Okay, so eretz being earth or land, same word we had in Genesis 1. And then midbar, really common word for desert. And that comes up quite a bit. Same word in desert modern here, by the way. So then in parallel with that is, uvetohu yelel yishmon, and in the howling waste of the wilderness, he encircled him and cared for him. So, so tohu is in construct with desert. Okay, so that is a similar idea that we have. And when you think about a desert, I watched a lot of Westerns growing up. My dad loves Westerns. One of the common ways people would get rid of people who they had problems with, some of the criminals would capture somebody. They wouldn't kill them. They would just send them into the desert. They would drop them off in the middle of a desert in the West and then just ride off in their horses. And you're looking around, there's no water, there's no animals, there's nothing. How are we going to survive? So I think that's an interesting picture of desert and what type of ideas maybe are they trying to get across there? So obviously contextual, he found him in a desert in a howling waste of wilderness. He encircled him and he cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. And so this is a story about how God chose the people of Israel. He chose them for himself, and he depicts them as a people that are basically stuck in a desert land. So this is a story of how God chose the people of Israel and how he chose them for his own, and he found them, metaphorically speaking, in this desert where there's no hope. Maybe there are a couple other instances we can use. Let's see, 1 Samuel 12:21. And do not turn aside after empty things that cannot profit or deliver, for they are empty. So this is where the word for empty, how they translate in ESV, is the word tohu. So tohu is used in stories about idols, for example, and talking about the things that just, they're vain. There's nothing there to what they are. Let's see, maybe a couple more. Yeah, so here's like an example of the idols in Isaiah 41:29. Behold, they are all a delusion. Their works are nothing. Their metal images are empty wind. And so you have this word for empty is how they translate empty wind. Isaiah 44:9 does a similar thing. All who fashion idols are nothing. The word for nothing there, tohu. So anyway, it's interesting that we have this word used to describe deserts and to describe idols. And I think there's one time where it describes a city that's destroyed. I can't remember for sure. But anyway, those are just a few instances where people can find this word and just see, okay, what else could we view what this word's like?
So we see something like emptiness, something like a wilderness or desert. I mean, that's really the place where we're at with tohu.
Yeah.
Interestingly, if we were to bring in John Walton here, he makes a fascinating point with the wilderness as a place that we have in other ancient Near Eastern texts, that a wilderness, a desert, can actually be said to be a place of non-existence in the text. So it is a place that exists physically, as we understand, right, on a on that particular level. But the way that the ancient Near Easterner will understand, it's a place of high disorder. It's a place of non-existence in that sense.
Which again, so I think it makes sense. Because when you look at a desert,
it makes very good sense.
You know, it's like there's nothing alive here. So, right.
Non-existence. Life can't be sustained. It's very harsh, very difficult. Everything is in disarray, especially if we think about what we have coming in the Genesis narrative, it makes good sense that we have tohu at this point. It is an empty wasteland. It is in high disorder or something to that effect, right? Yep. I think that's very interesting. So what about this bohu?
Yeah, so vohu, this word, yeah, again, it only appears three times. So I think that some, as I look at this word here, so Hallett, they put a little interesting note trying to explain this, where that it could be a rhyming formation. So yeah. In other words, this is a made-up word used to rhyme with tohu that then would add some sort of emphasis, add a little bit of an extra umph to something. But this is a very difficult word to figure out what's going on here. Let's see. They try to connect it potentially to a Phoenician deity and maybe to a Babylonian mother goddess. So again, this already gets into some of the research you're going to talk about later, where are these people trying to make connections to things? So there's Ba'av, some Phoenician potential deity, or Ba'u as a Babylonian mother goddess. Again, they have a lot of question marks they put around here, so it's not a strong connection they make. They say it comes from Baha, and we just don't know a lot about the word. And so, I mean, to me, I think it makes most sense personally that this is it's a word that rhymes with tohu. Maybe we just don't have enough ancient Hebrew literature to see it in more usage, but it could be a word that is just uniquely paired to create an extra emphasis of this tohu.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so actually to bring in some of that research, I want to raise a very interesting book that I've been reading, David Sumura's book, Creation and Destruction, a Reappraisal of the Chaos Comp Theory in the Old Testament. And he goes into great detail with regard to the linguistic understanding of tohu vavohu. Does a really, really nice job of tearing into the roots and looking at the various permutations and the different contexts in which they might appear. And of course, getting into the scholarly question of how do we understand this linguistically, especially on a comparative Semitic level, which I think is quite interesting. And he actually goes toward Ugaritic mythology and literature to sort of bring out the bohu piece potentially. And he connects it back, as do some other scholars, to Nabalkatum in Akkadian. And in those particular contexts that he really focuses on in the text are actually a barren womb, a womb that is barren. And it uses that particular root, if there is any sort of connection there with the root, that we have something that is not normal, if you will, that should be bearing fruit. And so in that sense, what we have is something like desolate and empty, I think, is ultimately where he would land on that particular interpretation of this tohu vavohu, and that it is like a wilderness state, and yet it's not normal as well. And that's the bohu piece that is being emphasized. And this makes good sense, because the way that Genesis is going to move forward is we're going to move to high order and normality by the time we get to the end of Genesis 1.
And life.
And life, precisely. Yep. And life, especially coming forth from that. So the question that we have to then ask is tohu vavohu something like with Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian creation narrative? And it's very interesting, in Enuma Elish, we do have, it seems, at the very start of the tablet, in tablet one, we do have this idea of creation that comes forth, how the gods create, et cetera, and so forth. I don't want to get into the real details of it. But then Enuma Elish quickly moves from that into a sort of battle between Tiamat, who is the basically the goddess of the sea, if you will, and battling against Ea, battling against Anu. These are other gods in Babylonian mythology. And it is that battle that happens that is really sort of the chaos motif that Hermann Gunkel was going towards and was thinking about. And interestingly, it is out of that. It is the son of Ea, Ea being his father, Marduk, who is the one who is able to overcome Tiamat and bring the chaos creatures to naught, the chaos creatures that were created just for the battle itself. Marduk is then enthroned as sort of the supreme god of the pantheon in Babylon, et cetera, and so forth. And so actually what we have with Enuma Elish is actually something less like, I think, a creation narrative that is strictly focused on creation, and something more like the coronation of Marduk and how Marduk came to be the supreme god of Babylon. And that's really the emphasis of Enuma Elish. Nevertheless, there are many scholars out there who want to continue to stress that what we have in Genesis 1-2, especially here with Tohu Vavohu, but then we can move forward to Tehom.
Yep.
We see a connection there potentially. So let's talk about Tehom here in Genesis 1-2. I'm going to put the screen back up here so that we can see it. We have Alpene Tehom Vechoshek Alpene Tehom. So we have this word here, Tehom, which means something like the deep. But it was Hermann Gunkel who suggested that Tehom is actually from the same cognate as Tiamat. Essentially, it was taken from the idea of Tiamat as a goddess, demythologized here in Genesis 1 to just refer to the deep, i.e. the waters of the deep or the oceans of the deep. And so the question is that correct? Is Tehom really just a demythologized understanding of Enuma Elish and the Tiamat motif that we have there?
Yep, that's the big question, right?
It's a big question, yes.
Yeah, because I mean, this is probably the strongest, probably the most used linguistic tie when people want to say, hey, Genesis 1 is directly borrowing from Enuma Elish.
Right.
And here is the first proof.
Tehom, that is correct.
Tiamat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's the question. I think, what's that? It's interesting to get to the etymological level. You did some really interesting research on this, where we can get into that part. You know, my initial thought when we try to connect this Tehom to the sea goddess, and like Genesis 1 is just straight up borrowing from this. You already mentioned, okay, it's maybe a demythologized version of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think for some, they try to make this be a god is having a battle against something to overcome, to create.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like a stretch when we look at the story. Like it's just where's
the battle?
Where do I see a battle here that's going on? I wonder if you can get into the etymology of Tehom from that research you did.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And that's really where we're at here. Is there a battle going on here? Something like what is happening in Enuma Elish. But again, the central motif, the central point of Enuma Elish is how Marduk comes to be the supreme god, right? It's not so much on the creation narrative. And I think that's an important point to stress because here in Genesis 1, it is very much not telling us how it is that the God of Israel becomes the supreme God of all the other gods, right? That is not what Genesis 1 is doing at all, because there are no other gods in Genesis 1, right? But we do have God doing the order and then resting in the seventh day. So there is something like a kingly motif. I'm certain of that the high order has been created. John Walton's done some great work on that. To that end, ending in sort of temple motif and the like. But let's talk about Tehom and Tiamat. Now, this is the interesting thing that David Sumura has presented in his research, and he does a fantastic job of just taking you step by step through this question of whether or not Tehom is a direct borrowing from Tiamat, if that's the sense. And he says no. He says you can't actually do it linguistically. You can't get from you can't go from Tiamat in Akkadian and actually end up with Tehom in Hebrew. He says it actually would end up very differently. And his point is simply this, to just put it out there and to make it short, not go through all the linguistic arguments, is that Tehom and Tiamat are actually coming from the same common Semitic root, Tiham. So the Proto-Semitic root Tihom is how we get Tiamat, but also how we get Tehom. And he says the fact that we have Tehom in the way that it is pronounced here in this particular text, the way it's presented in the consonantal text, shows that it's coming from the Proto-Semitic root, not coming down through Tiamat, if you will, in that particular sense. And Tihom in a Proto-Semitic root simply means ocean. And that's what it is referring to. So you see why even in Babylonian literature with Tiamat, Tiamat also means ocean as well. It's just that in Enuma Elish, it's mythologized. Tiamat is a deity. So here, though, that's why they say this is a demythologized text here in Genesis 1. That's where the scholars would go with it. But we don't have that, do we? We don't have to have that because the Proto-Semitic root would be Tihom. Now you say, well, what does Proto-Semitic mean, says to our listeners, right? What is that? So it was believed that at one time we had one Semitic language that eventually broke out into the many families of Semitic languages that we have. For example, we have Akkadian in an East Semitic language. We have a whole score of West Semitic languages that came forth, Hebrew being one, Arabic. We have Aramaic, right? We have Ugaritic. We have all these ancient Semitic languages, plus we have modern languages as well. And they're all related to one particular, what they call proto-language. And what's interesting is that the root systems are shared between the Semitic languages. So,
yeah, and this is something that, by the way, obviously for anyone listening, like, you could type proto and then any language and you're going to find something to pop up, because this is a common idea within linguistics.
Yeah.
That, you know, languages didn't just pop out of nowhere, but they have a history. They almost have like a family history, you could say.
Yeah.
And I love getting into this stuff in general. It's just really fun and nerdy. I was watching a video the other day about, you know, going through Indo-European languages, specifically into the Germanic languages and, you know, Proto-Germanic and where we get English and, you know, Old English and Old Norse, and we get the modern Scandinavian. It's fun. It's fun stuff. And so basically the argument then is that Tehom and Tiamat are coming from a Proto-Semitic root that diverges into these nuances in these different languages. It's not that Tehom is an Akkadian word that is then being directly borrowed by Hebrew. They both have their own connection to a Proto-Semitic. So it's a really interesting research that was done there.
Yeah, and his conclusions are quite good with that. And the idea then here, if Tehom is, as it is, coming from that Proto-Semitic root, meaning ocean, then all we have here essentially is that the oceans are overflowing and they cover everything. And that is, I think, the idea that is being presented. Because as you've noted, we have no creation of the waters, do we? We have no creation. They're just here. The Tehom is here. The oceans of the deep are here. And that's what we have in Genesis 1. But there's absolutely no direct correlation to Tiamat, according to this. Now, that being said, we're still within the Weltanschauung, right? We're still within the ancient worldview of the ancient Near East. So there would be no question that some of the very general motifs and ideas that we have in Enuma Elish, especially in that very first tablet that's dealing with creation on some level, what we have here in Genesis 1, there's no reason why those wouldn't be related. And I think it's easy to say that we have Tiamat in Enuma Elish in a Babylonian narrative, and we have Tehom in Genesis 1, because the ancients believed it began somehow with the waters at the beginning, you know, in that sense.
Well, I wonder if we can explore this motif a little bit more, talking about an Ugaritic culture where you have Baal, who the storm god, who, by the way, that's where we learn a lot about Baal, which is super interesting, but the storm god who fights against this ocean deity. But as you've noted, what's important is that Ugaritic story is not a creation story.
Right. And again, David Samura does a really great job of this. He notes that specifically to suggest that, because others have taken that motif that we have, again, a battle with the sea. Of course, Yam in the Ugaritic literature, we have this battle with the sea. with the storm god. But he says it's that particular motif is not the same sort of motif that we have in Enuma Elish. It's a different motif. In this case, it is a storm god battling with the sea. And that is what is a derivative from the West Semitic culture, i.e. the Amorites probably, also with the Ugaritishans as well. It is those particular cultures that are bringing that storm motif with the sea, that battle happening with the sea. It's that motif that probably reaches into Babylon from the West.
It's such an interesting idea that a theory that may have started with, okay, Enuma Elish, that's the original stuff. Genesis clearly has to be borrowing from that. Whereas, like you said, potentially the Amorites are bringing this over, which that's where you have people like, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on his name.
Hammurabi.
Yeah, Hammurabi. Right. So he's obviously hugely influential.
Right.
In so much of the Mesopotamian culture. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to think this could almost come full, like do a 180, where maybe some of this battling an ocean deity originates in the West.
It's a wonderful point. Even with Enuma Elish, I mean, it's written later, but borrowing from a much earlier time, probably maybe from the time of Hammurabi somehow. But the texts themselves coming quite later, I believe, even with Nebuchadnezzar the First. But in any case, what you said is important. In the Baal myth, in the Ugaritic myth, we don't have a creation narrative battling with the sea. We just have a storm battling with the sea. That's it. And so we can't use that particular imagery here for Genesis 1 either. And in any case, it's not here. There is no storm. Yeah, go ahead.
So let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. So one motif that does seem to be present that we see in a lot of these ancient Eastern cultures, important to note that it's not exclusive to creation stories, but like, why is the ocean represented as a villain in ancient Near East stories? And then what's interesting is, although Genesis 1, clearly there's no other gods in this story, but why would it be that in this creation story we have water that's just there? Why do we not learn about like how the water was created in the story? Do you have any thoughts on?
Well, no, I don't actually have any original thoughts to say to that end, but it is interesting, as I noted, that with Enuma Elish, at least we do begin with the waters, and that's where creation begins with. And, I think that motif coming through here, it has to be that if you just, on a cosmic geographical level, the ancients, the ocean was, the seas were very important, right? It was their cosmic geography understood that there was the ocean, but then there were the depths that went under the land, right? And that is the place of the real deep. And that is also leading right close to Sheol. Yeah. I mean, it's the underworld. It's that whole thought. And that sometimes the waters could come up, you know, through the land, and as we have in Genesis 1-2 with the separation of the waters above and the waters below, that whole canopy of waters that you can have up top. So the waters, I'll say this too, like we have with Tohu, with the wilderness, a place of non-existence or a place that is impossible to support life, so too with the sea. But the sea even more so, because once the boat breaks down, it's over.
we're fish out of water at that point.
That's right.
Right.
And once the monsters come, it's really over. Yeah. Yes. So the sea has to be, if the wilderness is a place of non-existence in I don't want to use the word chaos, but yes, chaos, it can't, life can't be supported so much, how much more the sea, right?
Maybe you can break down what's kind of the difference between like chaos versus emptiness.
Well, that's what I'm trying to avoid, I think, is because in English, nothing really. I mean, right? Well, chaos might have more of a force of.
What are these early German scholars getting at when they talk about chaos? Do we have an idea what they're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, they go into it quite with really good depth, I think, to talk about chaos. But in Enuma Elish, the interesting piece is the anger that comes forth from Tiamat, and she prepares herself for battle, And so there is an essence of judgment and anger in that particular element. And so I think when we hear the word chaos, I think from a postmodern perspective for us, I mean, post-enlightened, you know, modern perspective, chaos is something we like to think in the natural elements from a naturalistic worldview. Space is chaos, right? Nothing can be precise, can be sustained in outer space or anything to that end. But then there's high order there as well, right? I mean, to some extent, there is high order, but it is an empty wasteland, an empty space, if you will. So I think chaos has that. But from an ancient Near Eastern perspective, especially to Numa Elish, the chaos that comes forth, it's done so in anger. And though it's reflecting upon the natural elements of the world, right? It's reflecting on the experience of the ancient Near Easterners in nature, because it can be chaotic, right? A tornado can be quite chaotic. Yeah. I think in a mythological sense, there is a divine anger there somewhere. So that's what I'm trying to say, is that I think the difference between chaos and empty wasteland is that there is a moral element, maybe not moral element, but maybe a will behind it on some level.
I see. I don't know.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say.
One of the ways I like asking my students a question in Genesis 1, verse 1 through 2. I did this one semester just as a case study. I just wanted to see where, you know, your average Christian college student is at. Is I read, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. Okay, very typical translation.
Yeah.
And I had them all close their eyes, and then I just had them raise their hand. I said, okay, I want to ask you, how do you feel? How do these verses make you feel? Does it feel positive, like a blank slate for an artist about to put a paintbrush on the canvas? Okay. Yeah. Option one, positive. Neutral is just whatever.
Just what it is. Yeah.
Just all right, just let's move on. Like, why are we stopping? Let's just get to the creation stuff. And then the third option was, I'm trying to remember the exact adjective I used, something more like, I don't know if scared was the word I used, but like something that's a tad bit like disturbing, like this isn't good. And it was very interesting to get the responses, you know, where some students, now again, I'm not saying these students did deep study of Hebrew Bible, you know, but I think we just need to realize, for most of us, we're just approaching the Bible, you know, from an English translation and maybe not doing a lot of deep study necessarily. And I wonder if this is a more casual way to address this whole chaos idea. What is the status of things before Genesis 1 verse 3, and God said, let there be light?
Right.
How are we feeling about this? Mm-hmm. So this gets into, is there a will? Is there a chaos thing? Mm-hmm. Is this just another way of saying, hey, it's a blank slate. There's nothing here. And God's about to do some awesome stuff. Watch him just go and create. Or is there like maybe a negative feeling to this? Like, this is not how things are supposed to be. This is bad. This is not what things should be like. And then, here comes God to come in and save the day, to make things great.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of the conundrum that, or the third option is just, again, this is just a very neutral statement. It's just, we're just saying nothing's here, and then now we're going to talk about how things are there.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of thoughts we get to bring into this. For some, again, you alluded to our modern naturalistic, like we're very concerned about the biological, physical origin of things. Like, that's really what I want to see. Like, tell me exactly what God mixed together to create water and earth and people and animals. But there's something bigger going on here. And so, you know, personally, I feel like I see two possible sides. I think both. This could just simply be, hey, this is just the ancient people describing nothing. This is them looking at a state of non-existence, and they're just describing that to us with vocabulary that they use to describe deserts, for example, or the vocabulary they use to describe the ocean. And when you look at the ocean and the desert, it's like, you know, it's a way of saying there's no society, there's no human, there's no civilization. Like, what is there? So that's a legit option I see. The other option that is just interesting to me is the potential that Genesis 1-2 is giving us a portrayal of a negative situation. And not that there's a negative situation because God created something bad, like he messed up and had to redo something, or not because there was some divine battle between deities and God's trying to overtake this other God to become the supreme God, but that it maybe gives a different kind of portrayal of the type of things that God also does, that God is the one who goes into a place of darkness and brings life and brings light. He's the type of God who into places of anti-life brings life. And that's what he does. And he takes things that are barren and gives them birth. And so when you go through the rest of the Hebrew Bible, we see this is a common motif of God. How many stories are there of barren women who then have children? How many stories of people who they are actually in a situation of chaos or destruction, of evil, but God enters into that situation. So kind of zooming forward to New Testament a little bit, I think John 1 is an interesting picture, how the world is a place of darkness. And Jesus is this portrayed as this light that enters into the world, and the darkness cannot, whether you have comprehend or overcome or whatever, but can overcome him. And so part of me wonders, could there just be a little bit of abstract metaphorical language going on with this deep and water with a little bit of that motif? Because once you get to the New Testament, you have, why is it that they have a story of Jesus specifically stopping a sea storm? Of all the storms that he's going to stop, could there be a tad bit of that imagery going on? Because especially Revelation, though, I think the very end, second to last chapter, you have this wonderful, there's a new heaven, new earth. And what's the next line? And the seas are no more.
Yeah.
I often ask, like, what does God not like, you know, tubing? I mean, we talk about how, you know, you grew up with your dad on boats and you're driving boats and everything. What's the big deal? Let's go to the lake house. It's fun.
Right.
But could it be that every once in a while, if you track through your Bible, we have some stories of this Leviathan figure living in the ocean, this ancient Near East cosmology, and the deeps being below the earth and the heavens, and sometimes portrayed as the villain of the story is there. And so could there be something where Genesis 1 is potentially telling us a story of how this is the type of God who we serve, is that in places that look like anti-life, he creates life. What looks like darkness, he creates light. So I kind of want to toss this to you, but I guess the first thing I want to make very clear is in this theory, I don't think either of these theories leads to a place like, oh, Genesis 1 is no longer a story that God actually didn't create everything. I think personally, the idea of ex nihilo is it's a core principle of church history that we see in multiple biblical passages. So again, it doesn't explain why. So it's basically, I think that's another maybe theory that kind of toyed out. Do you have any thoughts?
I mean, well, in a brilliant sense. I mean, we showed the NRSV and the NET. One is ex nihilo, the other one's not.
Yeah.
But both have their arguments, scholarly, linguistically, et cetera, and so forth, to suggest that maybe in a very brilliant way, the Hebrew writer has made it both, right, in one sense.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting to see that debate go forth. So no, I think you're right. An ancient Israelite would have fully understood God creates everything. Absolutely, full stop, no questions asked. The question is, though, Genesis 1 and 2, what's really happening there? And I think you brought up a good point about metaphor. That's actually where David Sumuru ends with regard to much of this. He just suggests that what we have with the sea imagery, especially later on with Leviathan in the passages that we have it, but also here in Genesis 1 to 2, is nothing more than a greater metaphor for this idea of empty and barren, if you will, right? A wilderness and barren. And we don't have a primordial battle of cosmic origins happening like we do in Enumeli. It's just not there. But what we do have are metaphors with the sea for these greater things. And I think the New Testament is an excellent example to take Genesis 1, present it in the way that it does. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, et cetera, and so forth, right? And we see the light imagery that we have in John 1 as well, in John chapter 1. And so I think those are great examples to show how metaphor works itself out with these very chaotic natural images that we have from human experience. But if I were to throw up here the accordance module again. Mm-hmm. And I think it's quite interesting if we go back to that Northwest Semitic storm imagery.
Mm-hmm.
So we have darkness on the face of Tehom, right? On the face of the deep. But then we have the next line, Ve'ruach Elohim. Now here, this is interesting because, and I don't know if that's where Hermann Gunkel and some of these others are going with it. I'd have to look back at their at the work and really see. But if that is the connection that's being made to some of the Ugaritic mythology and some of that literature, then you can see why. Because Ruach is the next word after Tehom. And Ruach here could be translated in three ways. We can translate this, obviously, the Spirit of God. Mm-hmm. We could translate it the wind of God, right?
Mm-hmm.
The wind blows where it wishes. You don't know where it comes from or where it's going. So is everyone who's born of the Spirit, right? So you have Jesus pulling on that particular imagery.
Yeah.
But it could also be the breath of God, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have the next line, Vayomer Elohim, Yehi Orl, and Vayehi Orl. So he's about to speak over the face of the deep. So you have all of that imagery.
Yeah.
And of course, it's windy. And what's in a wind? A storm is in the wind.
Yeah, that's a really good point. A storm
can be very windy. Yeah. So again, not borrowing, but definitely part of the Weltanschauung, part of the ancient Near Eastern cultural area, and we're focusing in there on the West Semitic, Northwest Semitic world. So,
by the way, this is a brilliant point you're bringing up, the Ruach. We see God depicted as this throughout the Hebrew Bible, actually.
We do. That's a good point. God,
especially, let's even go for the big one at Mount Sinai, that's covenant.
Exactly.
God's presence is depicted as a storm on this mountain.
Yeah.
And that's great. The way that God got the kavod, the glory of God, comes down upon the tabernacle and the temple. So this wouldn't be a unique, like a one-off of describing God's presence, you know, being
exactly
being here.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's so interesting to me.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting. And I think, again, at the very core of this, we have these waters and God is about to do something that's going to bring high order, as we understand it, to sustain life, especially human life.
Yes.
At the very end of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I think at the end of the day, you know, some people are familiar with the theories, some aren't. And I think at the end of the day, I hope people would realize that if there's a little bit going on with, let's say this isn't just an ancient Near East way of describing nothing, that if there's a little bit extra going on with these metaphors, there's nothing to be afraid of here. And so like you alluded to, maybe Genesis 1:1 is clearly saying an ex nihilo story, or maybe it's not technically describing an ex nihilo story, God creating out of nothing, or maybe it could be a mixture of both. I don't personally think there's anything to be afraid of here, that we can just continue to try to read the story in its original context and see what type of story is the author of Genesis 1 and also Genesis 2. What stories are we getting at here, and what are they trying to say?
Exactly.
Because first, bottom line, as you said, the ancient Hebrew author, they think that God created everything. Mm-hmm. And in a Christian sense, you can also go through the New Testament and everything. That's very clear. Mm-hmm. And so maybe there's a different point the author wants to get across. So for example, let's just say the story is maybe best interpreted as it's not a technical ex nihilo story because we have waters and this stuff there. Like, what's the point? I think, you know, the things the metaphors do is they show us more of the character of God. If it's only ex nihilo story, what we see is that God is really powerful. He created everything. He's very powerful. Mm. What he creates is good. If there's a little bit of metaphor stuff going on, I think it adds an additional thing we learn about God, which is that God enters into things that are dark or anti-life and brings light and life to those things.
Yeah,
and so that lines up with Jesus being the one who he touches the leprous person, loving him and heals him. It's this going into the situations. And I think if I get a little devotional here for a moment, I hope people realize, again, regardless of how we interpret Genesis 1, I hope people realize your situation is never this too dark, too far gone, too bad that God cannot enter into your life and bring life to things that feel like it's too far. There's no hope. Maybe you would describe your life as chaos, But no matter what you describe it as, God can enter into your life and bring life and light into a situation that feels like there could not be.
The Lord can bring order to a room that is tohu vavohu, yeah?
Yes.
Yes. Full of balagan, yes. I think you're right. And we shouldn't look, because what we have coming is he's going to look and see that it is tov after he does the ordering, right? So we would never say that there's something like evil here. What we would say is the best you could do is low tov, but you don't even have that. That doesn't come till it's low tov for the man to be alone, right? You know, that's the first moment that you have that.
It's so good.
Yeah. So what we have here is just something, I think, like you described, it's exciting. Verses 1 and 2 should bring you to a place of excitement to see what's going to happen in verse 3, ultimately. So,
and I think we'll hopefully inspire people to want to study more, too, because the theories that are so copy-paste, like Genesis 1 through 11 especially, but like Genesis 1 through 11, it's mere Control-C, Control-V from Mesopotamia. Right. Like, that's just, there's so much more nuance going on here, and it makes it a fun thing to explore.
It does.
And so I'm glad you did, you know, some of this research here. I think there's some really interesting
things. There is. Yes. And if you would like to jump into it more, our listeners, you can buy Creation and Destruction by David Sumura, A Reappraisal of the Chaos Comp Theory in the Old Testament. It's very technical, so you'll want to know that on the front end, but it's excellent. Very good book. So
I'll put a link to that in the show notes or the description below.
Yeah. Maybe we'll get David, we'll get Dr. Tsumura on, and
maybe we'll have him on the podcast. That's great.
We'll have to interview him. So
you have any last thoughts?
No, I just think that what we were saying here about God bringing order and light in the darkness, I think, is exceptional. I think we see that moving towards the New Testament, and we see those metaphors, though metaphorical, doesn't make it any less literal, right? I mean, it's just, it's describing that very hopeful thing that that our world needs. So,
this has been fun. This is great.
Very good. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for joining us on this conversation. We'll see you in the next one.
Yep. Take care.